ICE is escalating deportation operations around the Los Angeles area. But if you are stopped by ICE officers, you have constitutional rights, regardless of your immigration status. If you or someone you know has been detained or wants to report ICE, more information is available at CIRLA at 888-624-4752 for legal help and resources. It is bilingual. More information at CHIRLA.org.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and at kpfk.org for the world.
Well, hello, friends. This is Maria Hall, welcoming you to the Lawyers Guild Show. My co-host Jim Lafferty will be joining us in the second half hour today, so stay tuned. We have two really interesting topics and guests today, so I hope you'll stay with us for the whole hour. First, I'll be interviewing attorney Alvaro Huerta, the director of litigation and advocacy over at Immigrant Defenders Law Center. So he'll be giving us the scoop from the front lines of the battle for immigrant rights in Los Angeles and beyond. And then in our second half hour, we'll be speaking with Brazil expert Professor James Green. He'll tell us about the very controversial criminal trial of Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, who is sometimes known as the Trump of the tropics. And given his friendship with Donald Trump, Bolsonaro's that is, the punitive actions that the U.S. has imposed on Brazil as a result. So stay tuned for that. But right now, we're going to jump into our first segment, which I recorded just a couple hours ago in order to make room in Alvaro's busy, busy schedule for us. So, D'Angelo, go ahead and roll the interview.
This segment, we'll hear about the courageous people on the front lines who are fighting for the rights of immigrants and, by extension, fighting for the rights of each and every one of us in the United States. We'll hear about advocates who are in the streets and in the courtrooms, on Zoom, on hotlines, and at community clinics. Some advocates you may have seen on the news, but others, the vast majority in fact, are quieter, working behind the scenes, doing the work of organizing, coordinating, and relieving suffering of those who are directly in this administration's crosshairs. And we'll even hear about some good news in the courts. Our guest is one of my favorite people, attorney Alvaro Huerta, the director of immigration and advocacy for Immigrant Defenders Law Center, otherwise known as IMDEF. Alvaro has been fighting for immigrants' rights for years, not only at times when immigration is making headlines like right now, but also when it's not. And his dedication and experience is what has led him to this moment, and he is exactly the right person for this job at this critical time. Alvaro Huerta, welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thanks for having me, Maria.
So can you start out by telling us about Immigrant Defenders Law Center, which is not only your workplace, but one of the organizations that has taken on so many immigration battles right now? What are its main program areas and who does it serve?
So Immigrant Defenders Law Center, or IMDEF as we like to call it, is the largest provider of legal defense removal services in Southern California, basically in California. So our primary purpose is to help people ensure that they have an attorney in immigration court when they're facing deportation. And we do that with various programs. We have a lot of populations that we help. We have a huge children's program. We also help a number of adult clients, many of who are mentally incompetent to represent themselves. We also help deported veterans attempt to try to return back to the United States. And we provide services throughout, like I said, Southern California, including Los Angeles, San Diego, Orange County, Riverside, and other places in Southern California.
Great. And you also, I know, do a lot of litigation, which we're going to talk about in a moment. But let's start out also by, in addition to MDEF, which is one of the major organizations out there, and in addition to other lawyers on the front lines with you, what other groups and coalition partners are out there staying strong who have been more in the background, just tirelessly providing support at times when immigration is in the news and when it's not?
Yeah, we're lucky in Southern California to have a really strong immigrants' rights network and lots of really fantastic organizations that are really doing the work, like you said, behind the scenes, oftentimes not getting credit, but really ensuring that our communities stay safe. There are a number of groups, including the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles, CARESAN, the Central American Resource Center, Public Counsel, groups of car wash workers, the National Day Labor Organizing Network, helping folks who are day laborers, groups of home healthcare workers, lots of organizations in California doing the hard work every day.
Well, I remember, you know, back in early June when ICE operations first started in LA in this major scale, there was so much confusion about where people were being held after being arrested and where they were being shipped off to. What's the status on that? Is it any easier to find detainees now, or, you know, is it more organized now, or is it still chaotic?
You know, it depends on after what we see after a raid. It has gotten a little easier to track folks just because the number of arrests have gone down. And I know we're going to be talking about the case where we got a temporary restraining order to prevent the government from doing these roving patrols. So it has gotten a little easier to track folks just because the numbers are down. It still can be difficult, though. People are principally, if they're arrested or detained in the Los Angeles area, they're usually taken to what's called B18, or the basement of the federal building in downtown Los Angeles. And because it takes a while for folks, especially if they are not in the immigration system before, to get assigned what's called an A number, sometimes it's hard to track folks down until they're assigned that number. But because the numbers are down, we are seeing that process go a little more smoothly. Once people are processed through B18, they're often sent to Adelanto. That's the closest federal facility near us, which isn't that close. It's still about a 2-hour drive from Los Angeles to get to out in the desert in the Antelope Valley. And then they could be sent to other facilities as well. And we've heard of some people being processed through the Santa Ana facility in Orange County. And then some people are sent to detention facilities in San Diego, for example, at Otay Mesa.
Where's Otay Mesa, you said?
Otay Mesa is down in San Diego, about an hour and a half, I think, east of San Diego, I think it's. Mm-hmm.
Are you seeing them staying within Southern California then, for the most part?
For the most part, we're seeing folks staying in Southern California, but there is a fear that as these detention facilities reach their capacity, folks could be sent outside of Southern California. That's definitely something that we've seen in the past when some of these facilities reach capacity. Adelanto has two facilities there. One is called the Desert View Annex, and then there's Adelanto proper. During the COVID pandemic, Adelanto was actually closed. That was shut down. That recently came back online this year. And the administration has said that they do intend to get that to reach capacity, which is almost 2,000 people that can be taken at that facility.
Wow. And then when people are there, can they receive visitors? Can they receive, you know, their lawyer visitors or family members?
They can. At these federal facilities, there are family visitation hours, and attorneys are allowed to visit detainees 24 hours a day. They just often have to make an appointment in advance in order to get access. But we do have various protections at some of these facilities, ensuring that they have access to counsel, including telephone access. The Adelanto facility, for example, IMBEF was a plaintiff organization in a case that recently settled there, which ensures that they'll have access to counsel and specifically have confidential access to telephone calls to counsel, which unfortunately, especially during the pandemic and when Adelanto was online earlier, was difficult. People were being charged for phone calls to their attorneys, for example, and we're ensuring that that doesn't happen anymore.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay, well, let's talk about one of the many lawsuits that IMDEF is one of the plaintiffs, and you're actually one of the lawyers as well, and you're in very good company. It's an amazing group that brought this lawsuit, and I'm speaking of the suit called Vasquez Perdomo versus Noam et al., and it's over the ICE's use of unconstitutional tactics in making arrests. So can you tell us a little bit about that case? Who are the parties? And what are the main legal claims and remedies that you're seeking?
Sure. So yes, the Vasquez Perdomo v. Noam case, which, you know, we kind of like call the LA raids case sometimes, even though it actually is beyond LA. It's the seven counties in Southern California are all part of this case. And so this was brought by a number of individual plaintiffs and organizational plaintiffs who challenged the administration's use of these roving patrols and these raids that we've all seen in the news now happening in Southern California and actually outside of California as well. So the plaintiffs in the case brought both Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment challenges, amongst many other challenges, but kind of that's the heart of it. The Fourth Amendment challenge is saying that the administration and these, and specifically Department of Homeland Security, ICE, and CBP are using unlawful tactics to stop someone, detain them without any reasonable suspicion, and often based on racial profiling, whether someone speaks only Spanish or English with an accent, where they're located. Some of our plaintiffs, for example, were picked up at a bus stop, and also where they might work. One of our plaintiff organizations represents other organizations that, for example, are in the car wash campaign. So a lot of car washes have been targeted, Home Depot parking lots were targeted. And we basically argued that that was a violation of the Fourth Amendment because they were using information that isn't necessarily mean that someone's in the country unlawfully. And so it didn't really amount to reasonable suspicion. And then the Fifth Amendment claims were really focused on the people being detained at B18 because they were not being given access to counsel. They were being denied phone calls. And when an attorney went to visit, they were often made to wait a really long time or could only speak to someone for about 15, 20 minutes in oftentimes a not confidential space. So we were really challenging through the Fifth Amendment people's access to counsel that it was being denied, and access to, again, confidential spaces and telephone calls. So that case, we have had success. We did get a temporary restraining order on both of those claims. And we did, like I said earlier, we have seen the numbers of arrests and detentions go down and these roving patrols go down. But we still continue to challenge that case kind of at various levels.
Well, great. And doing my homework for that, for this interview, actually, I did go on PACER and was looking up the court documents. I noticed that there were some amicus briefs and then also that some of the records seemed to be sealed. So I don't know if they're allowing access to the public for some of those.
Yeah, so we were kind of working through the kinks. This case was originally brought as a habeas case, and for that reason, there were a number of documents under seal. We're hoping that we're going to be able to unseal the full case soon, but we're working with the government to kind of jointly stipulate to that. So hopefully all those documents will be unsealed soon. And I didn't mention earlier, but importantly, a number of cities and counties have joined the case as interveners. So that's been great to see that a lot of local Southern California communities are really kind of stepping up and standing up for their residents as well.
Great. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is KPFK 90.7 FM, the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Maria Hall, and I'm speaking with attorney Alvaro Huerta, the director of immigration and advocacy for Immigrant Defenders Law Center. Okay, so Alvaro, now, even though the courts have ordered the government to stop racial profiling in their search for undocumented immigrants, I know that was one of the victories that you've recently seen. If you could talk about that. And then also, what about if they continue to violate the court order? What options are there going forward, especially given that the United States Supreme Court seems to go with Trump and overturning a lot of the federal court decisions. How does that all play together in kind of strategy going forward?
Yeah, so we have seen, unfortunately, what we think are violations of the temporary restraining orders, with the government continuing to do some targeted raids. We're seeing fewer roving patrols, but you know, we want to be very vigilant and ensure that we're documenting this as much as possible. So to the extent that people do see the government engaging in what we think amount to violations of the temporary restraining orders, they should please reach out to document them themselves if they're there, and then reach out with any information you have to the council on this case, or the many organizations that I mentioned earlier who are all involved in some way, or can get the information to council. But we do want to make sure that we're documenting everything, because we do have a preliminary injunction hearing in late September before the district court. And we would want to present any evidence of any violations of the temporary restraining order before Judge Frimpong, who's the judge on the case. We have talked about potentially raising these issues before that hearing. And so again, to the extent we can document anything, that'll be very useful to us.
Oh, that's so interesting. So as far as for that hearing, can you explain what the preliminary injunction would do for listeners? And then, yeah, how important it would be to get that evidence to you?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, we have two temporary restraining orders on both the Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment claims, but they are only temporary. So this preliminary injunction hearing will be our opportunity to get that that order extended, right, to ensure that throughout the pendency of this case, the government is enjoined from doing what we believe are illegal actions, and we've kind of documented as legal actions, both in violation of the Fourth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment. So to the extent that we can provide even more examples of those violations, both, you know, since the temporary restraining order, especially, we can show that the government is not living up to its obligations and may need to be held, in violation of the court's orders during that preliminary injunction hearing, when we can provide more evidence.
Wow. I'm going to ask you at the end as well to give Immigrant Defenders Law Center the contact information. But just since we're talking about it right now, in case people aren't still on, can you let them know if they do have evidence of raids or racial profiling that have happened since that TRO, where would they send to? Who could they contact?
Yeah, they could. They should go on our website, www.imdef.org, and there's a way of signing up for information there. And I believe we do have, and I'm sorry, I don't have it right at my fingertips, but I think we do have a generic email address on the website that you can send information to. And that's probably the best way of reaching us.
Yes, perfect. So let's talk about another case that IMDEF has been involved with. And this has to do with children. It's challenging the Trump administration's elimination of legal counsel for 26,000 immigrant children. This happened back in March. That case is called Community Legal Services in Palo Alto versus DHS. And I hear you've had some victories on that front. So tell us about the case and then also the current status. Is it resolved or is it still going forward? What's going on?
Sure. So Community Legal Services in Palo Alto versus DHS is a case where we brought early during the Trump administration. The Trump administration had rescinded all funding for a number of organizations across the country that were providing legal services to unaccompanied children. And unaccompanied children are children who cross the border without a parent or legal guardian and were often put into foster care or detention because they have certain protections under the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, or TVPRA. Those protections include, to the extent practicable, that those children have legal representatives in their removal proceedings. And that's where organizations like IMDEF come in, because we're then assigned to be counsel to these children in their proceedings. There are close to 100 organizations across the country that serve that same function as well. The administration had pulled the rug out of all those organizations by rescinding the funding. And so we challenged that in court. We said that according to the TVPRA and other statutes, the administration, again, if Congress has appropriated money, which they have in this case, then the administration needs to provide those legal representatives to those children in their removal proceedings. We were fortunate enough to get both initially a temporary restraining order and then a preliminary injunction that kept that funding going to the various organizations providing those services to ensure that kids were represented in immigration court. Unfortunately, before we got those, there were a few weeks where kids were going to court showing up by themselves. They didn't have legal representatives. So we're lucky that we did get, you know, through our fight, you know, get that temporary restraining order and then preliminary injunction on the books. The government has since appealed the preliminary injunction to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and that remains pending. They also sought a petition for rehearing en banc on a different piece of the case that's also pending as well. So we're waiting to hear from the Ninth Circuit before we kind of take additional steps at the district court. So hopefully we'll be hearing from the Ninth Circuit on that case soon.
And then when you say kids or children, what are the ages of unaccompanied minors who are captured in this group of people?
It can range. We've had clients who are as young as 7 months old to then clients, you know, 17, 18. And so it really is runs the gamut in terms of ages. You often have a client, for example, who's a child themselves and might have a child. So you do have kids who are very tender age. And you can imagine, right, these kids attempting to be representing themselves in court, that just doesn't make sense. And so for lots of reasons, Congress has, you know, indicated that it will appropriate money to have these kids represented in court. It makes the whole system run a lot easier when you have someone speaking on behalf of these kids in court, when, you know, the immigration judge can ask questions of an adult versus asking questions of a five-year-old.
Wow. Well, let's talk about some of the victories, some of your other victories, because I know you see things on the front lines and you also see things in the courtrooms, but all of it, I think every time I see you, you have a smile on your face. So I know that somehow you're able to keep moving forward and really enjoy your work and find meaning in it in spite of all the bad news out there. So share some of the good news.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, MDEF's mantra and mission really is to ensure that no immigrant goes unrepresented in court. And, you know, unfortunately, under this administration, we're seeing a lot more losses. We're seeing a lot more appeals. We're seeing some people taken into immigration custody that wouldn't have been before. So we often have to remind ourselves that success has to be measured in a different way. And in large part, we take a lot of relief in knowing that our clients do have someone who has their back, who is representing them, even if the outcome's not always great. So I think we have kind of shifted our ideas of what success means. But I think what keeps me going is really seeing, for example, in these cases, that the raids that happened in Southern California, the community really stepping up, right? People documenting what they see, reporting what they see, being out there and intervening when they can, when they have that privilege, you know, if you're a citizen and don't have to worry about being deported. That means that we have a responsibility to stand up for our neighbors. And it's really heartening to see that that has been happening out in Southern California and in various communities. So that really keeps me going. I think those are wins. When we can see that community is stepping up for each other, that really provides that counter narrative that the federal government currently is saying, right, that people don't want immigrants in their communities. We know that's wrong because we see people standing up for each other in Southern California, throughout California and beyond.
That's so true. And just as a personal anecdote, I was talking to somebody from Washington, D.C. I guess it was just yesterday, and she was really getting inspiration from Los Angeles and the organizing that happens here. And because people in D.C. are in a totally different situation as far as, you know, more people are working for the government, now laid off or quit. So it's they're really admiring the culture that we have here of people sticking up for themselves and coming together. So I did want to pass that along to you. So what can ordinary people do, people who aren't necessarily immigration lawyers, or, you know, what can we all do to support you all in your work, support immigrant communities, and of course, keep fighting for the rule of law in the United States?
I think we have to keep holding government accountable, right? We have to, again, report any violations that we see. We have to understand our own rights, too. The only way that we can protect our rights is to understand them and to exercise them. And so, for example, we need to exercise those same rights. We have to remain silent when we're accosted by the police or federal agents. We have to ask for a lawyer. We have to ensure that we don't sign away our rights as well before talking to a lawyer, and making sure that other people understand those rights. So if you educate yourself about what those rights are under the Constitution, under our statutes, you know, pass that along to friends and family, making sure that you're uplifting what these organizations are putting out on social media, for example. That's always helpful to get the word out, because we need to really counter the narrative again that people are just going to let this become normal, right? We're not going to allow fascism to take hold without really speaking up and speaking out and exercising our rights. And also, like I said, intervening on behalf of others if we have the privilege to do so, always ensuring that our own safety, of course, is top of mind. But when you can, being out there and documenting things, I think, is really important, and sharing that information out so that people know how to exercise their own rights, what they can do, and getting involved again with local community organizations. Often these organizations could use volunteers. They could certainly use donations, or even just spreading the word. If you can't donate or volunteer, you can spread their social media messages, uplift those. And, you know, we often share things that you can do to take action, calling your Congress members, calling even local elected officials. There, like I said at the top of the program, we're very lucky that in Southern California, we do have a strong immigrants' rights network. And we do have a lot of support, for example, in the city council right now, trying to move some pro-immigrant ordinances. So, you know, learn what those are, support them when you can, add your public comment either in person or online, and really just be there for each other in community.
Yeah, that was so well said. Thank you so much. Of course, where can listeners find out more about IMDEF and other organizations?
So you can definitely follow IMDEF by signing up on our website, www.imdef.org. We send occasional newsletters, calls to action. You can also follow us on social media. We're on pretty much every platform. Just search for IMDEF Law Center or Immigrant Defenders Law Center, or IMDEF, some variation of that will show up. And follow some of these other organizations as well. CHIRLA, CARESEN, Public Counsel, the National Day Labor Organizing Network. So many organizations that are doing great work. And, you know, if you're looking for ways to support, we got you. All those organizations, including IMDEF, often post, you know, calls to action, things that you can do to get involved. And we always welcome the support.
Well, thank you so, so much for being with us today. Alvaro Huerta, Director of Immigration Advocacy for Immigrant Defenders Law Center, and we hope to have you back soon.
Thank you, Maria. Thanks for having me again.
Support for KPFK comes in part from the Levitt Pavilion Los Angeles, presenting outdoor concerts starting Saturday, June 28th through August 30th in MacArthur Park. The mission of Levitt Pavilion Los Angeles is to make live music accessible to all, creating stronger and more connected communities while celebrating the diversity of our city and beyond. Further information is available at levittlosangeles.org. That's L-E-V-I-T-T losangeles.org and kpfk.org.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.
All right. Well, we are back. This is the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Maria Hall, and my co-host Jim Lafferty and I had the great pleasure of interviewing Brazil expert Professor James N. Green yesterday about the controversial criminal trial of Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, who is being prosecuted for his role in planning a coup. We'll hear about that. And of course, the tensions it's creating in the United States because he is a friend of Donald Trump. So let's roll that interview.
Well, Maria, in this segment, we turn our focus to Brazil. Now, that's a country that is experiencing at least as much political polarization as the United States is, and maybe more. As the 2026 presidential elections in Brazil draw near, the world's eyes are on the criminal prosecution and house arrest of its former president, the far-right Bolsonaro, sometimes known as Trump of the tropics. In 2022, Bolsonaro lost re-election, but it was by the most narrow margin in Brazil's history. And his supporters and allies continue to hold substantial influence within Brazil's government. Donald Trump, of course, is a personal friend and ally of Bolsonaro. And since Bolsonaro's persecution, since that prosecution, Trump has levied massive tariffs against Brazil. The fact that Trump also imposed personal sanctions against the chief judge presiding over the case, including revoking the judge's U.S. visa, has led many to conclude, I think rightly, that Trump's tariffs in Brazil are more about retaliation, really, than trade. Well, our next guest will help us understand current U.S.-Brazilian relations and will remind us of the stakes. After all, Brazil is the world's fourth largest democracy, seventh largest economy in the world, and it's known as the Earth's lungs because it is home to a third of the world's rainforests. Our guest is James N. Green, professor in Brazilian history and culture, recently retired from Brown University, and former president of the Brazilian Studies Association. He serves as national co-coordinator of the U.S. Network for Democracy in Brazil, and he's the president as well of the board of the Washington Brazil office. He's also the author or co-editor of 11 books on Brazil, including Brazil, Five Centuries of Change, and Beyond Carnival, Male Homosexuality in 20th Century Brazil. Well, Professor James N. Green, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
It's great to be here.
Let's start, Mr. Green, with the criminal case against former Brazilian President Bolsonaro. What is he being prosecuted for exactly, and what punishment is the prosecution calling for?
So let me give a little background. In the 2022 elections, before the elections occurred, much like Trump, he argued that the election system, which are electronic voting machines, was fraudulent and it could not be trusted, and tried to change the voting patterns of the process. When he lost the vote 51-49 against Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who had been elected twice before, working class president of the country, he mobilized his supporters to block the roads. And that really backfired because people didn't really particularly like having the entire road system in the country shut down. And so he then encouraged his supporters to go to the military barracks around the country and demand for the military to intervene. This was happening after the elections in November and December. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was inaugurated on January 1st. And then a week later, his supporters who were in Brasilia at the main military headquarters there marched to the main center of power. There's a plaza there called the Plaza of Three Powers, which has the seat of the executive, judiciary, and legislative branches of the government, and broke into the buildings, destroying property and calling for the military to intervene. The idea was to provoke a situation in which Lula would fall into a trap of calling for a special provision, which would allow the military to restore order, and with that then carry out a military coup d'etat. Bolsonaro had actually gone to the United States after he lost the election and was operating out of Florida. And finally, after the invasion happened, there were charges made against him and seven other leading military figures and civilian leaders, including his vice presidential candidate, who had been the Minister of Defense. And he's been charged with attempting a coup, participating in an armed criminal organization, attempting violent abolition of the democratic order, and two charges about destroying property. And the background of this is, it's very important to keep in mind, Brazil had a military dictatorship from 1964 to 1985. And since then, it's been going through a long, slow process of consolidating democracy in the country. And this was a real setback because there was a real attempt to overthrow the government. And not only that, there were conspiracies to actually assassinate Lula, his vice presidential candidate, and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Well, Professor Green, how has Bolsonaro responded to his prosecution? I take it he hasn't pled guilty. So is he still influencing politics even though he's under house arrest?
So his son, who was in the Congress, went to the United States based out of Florida and started articulating within the right wing, the extreme right wing of the Republican Party support. His name is Eduardo Bolsonaro, and he had connections with Steve Bannon. He had participated in CPAC, and in fact, Steve Bannon had announced that he would be the next president of Brazil. He was joined by a journalist named Paulo Figueiredo, who was the grandson of the fifth military dictator during the 21 years of military rule. And they began arguing last year in Congress, or trying to argue in Congress, that Brazil was actually under a dictatorship, that Lula was an authoritarian ruler. And Alexandre de Moraes, at the time, the head of the Supreme Court, which is a rotating position. And it also, he was the head of the Federal Electoral Court, which is a system set up because elections in Brazil are centralized. He was in charge of a body that oversaw the elections. And so he had overseen the elections and guaranteed that they were in good order. And then he was overseeing the charges against Bolsonaro and others. So Bolsonaro has denied all of the allegations, even though there's extensive evidence from cell phone correspondence, his attempt to flee the country, conspiracies, all this documentation is there. One of his aides-de-camp turned state evidence and revealed a lot of this information. So the trial is going to start on September 2nd. It's expected to last about a month. It's likely that he will be convicted at this point, and he faces 40 years in prison. Now, in response to this situation, Trump decided to intervene in the domestic affairs of Brazil and attached to his 50% tariff demands on Brazil, which is one of the highest demands in the world, a demand for granting amnesty or freedom for Bolsonaro, which really backfired in Brazil. And people see this as a very direct interference in national politics and causing economic chaos. So whereas Eduardo Bolsonaro thought he was smart, he had the ear of Trump, and Trump thought he was going to make the situation in his favor, it's actually backfired. And so now a majority of people think that Eduardo Bolsonaro and the Bolsonaro family is responsible for the tariffs and blame them against them. So we'll see what happens if the United States backs down on the tariff demands, or what Trump will do if, in fact, Bolsonaro is convicted at some point at the end of the year. This year in September, October, there might be a slower process for the actual vote of the Supreme Court on this matter. Because in Brazil, all congressional representatives, senators, and high judicial appointees are all tried by the Supreme Court. They don't go through any other process. And so the Supreme Court will be trying the case, a group of judges, and then the overall Supreme Court will vote. I would predict the vote will be 9 for conviction and 2 against, given the makeup of the court.
Well, continuing on the same theme, one of Bolsonaro's, as you pointed out, famous allies is, of course, President Donald Trump, who is mucking about in the trial in a variety of ways. He's publicly singled out the chief judge in Brazil presiding over the case against Bolsonaro and imposed sanctions on him, such as revoking his U.S. visa. And then you've mentioned the massive tariffs that have been put on as well, leading some, of course, to argue the tariffs are about less about trade, more about Trump punishing those who are the enemies of Bolsonaro. I gather you agree with that?
Yes, and in fact, he's also imposed sanction on other Supreme Court judges. Again, the head of the Supreme Court rotates. Alexandre Moraes is overseeing this case at this moment. He's not the head, the Supreme Court judge at the moment. But they've also applied the McKinsey Act, which basically is declaring that there is a gross corruption in Brazil and there's sanctions against them. And so Alexandre Moraes, all of his international transactions are being frozen. Allegedly, if he does any interactions with any bank in Brazil that has international connections, they'll also be punished for this. It's really an outrageous violation of national sovereignty, as if countries around the world were to have interfered in the trials against Donald Trump, accusation of his being involved in the January 6, 2021 attempt to invade Congress and overturn the elections. And so that really has evoked a tremendous strong sense of nationalism in the country. The tariffs themselves are very punitive, and in large part they're aimed at several things. One is the fact that, like Europe, Brazil is trying to regulate social media by preventing material which is overtly fake news or is harmful or criminal from being removed by the platform. And of course, the social media platforms want to claim no responsibility for content. They just say that they're facilitating a conversation. And so that regulation is one of the things that has really got the big tech companies against Brazil and supporting the tariffs. And the other is banks, because Brazil developed a system of direct transfer of funds. It's called the PIX, which has become incredibly popular among working class poor people in the country, because it's a very inexpensive way to transfer money without having to go through banks. And they're claiming in a separate case that there's unfair trading practices and business practices that Brazil is committing against U.S. interests, which is justifying the high tariffs. There have been certain things that have been exempt from the tariffs, including orange juice, which is large export to the United States, also fertilizer and airplanes that Brazil makes a lot of small aircrafts, Embraer aircrafts that have been exempt, but many other items such as coffee and soybeans, et cetera, have been imposed in the tariffs. So over 1,000 other items are still being applied to 50%. And of course, this is going to cause tremendous burdens on the people of Brazil because of the disruption of the economy. And in the case of coffee, at least, probably a cup of Joe will go up another dollar. If you go to Starbucks the next couple of months, the price of coffee is going to skyrocket.
That is not good news. But let's turn now to the environment. Right now, Brazil is gearing up to host UN climate talks in November. And again, as Jim mentioned, Brazil is home to a third of the Earth's rainforests, and I understand it has the most biodiversity on the planet. So President Lula recently vetoed part of an environmental bill that advocates said would harm the Amazon rainforest. Yet the bill will also fast-track some other development projects. What can you tell us about this bill and about environmental politics within the Brazilian government generally?
So Brazil has five biomes. The first and the most well-known is the Amazon, because of all the ways in which people think of Brazil as a vast rainforest. But there's a cerrado, or a savanna, that surrounds that, which is really harmful because agro-business, especially soybean and cattle production, have been devastating the trees and the land around the Amazon region. And that's basically the area that holds the water that helps the Amazon rainforest function. And so the bill that was passed is being called the devastation bill, the environmental devastation Brazil bill, because it will lift all of the restrictions that have been placed on kind of devastation of land and misuse of land, controlling the way in which certain amounts of property is allowed to be deforested, but others have to be conserved. That's eliminated. So Lula vetoed 63 of the 398 provisions in the bill, and the Congress will likely override that because, unfortunately, the Congress is controlled by agribusiness, which is very much linked to the export of soy, cattle, and meat products. And so it's a setback, a serious setback for the environmental movement in Brazil.
Mm. And speaking of setbacks, I wonder, just last month, BP Oil announced that it Well, its largest oil and gas discovery off the coast of Brazil in more than 25 years. How might that discovery impact Brazil's economy and the environment? Given
so this is going to cause a real tension. The minister of the environment is Marina Silva, who comes from a very poor family. She was a rubber tapper. Her family were rubber tappers, and she was illiterate until she was 18. She rose to be a successful politician, environmental activist. She worked with a very important man named Chico Mendes, who was murdered by agribusiness. She was a senator. She was a minister under Lula's government in his first term in office. And she came back. She had criticism of the Lula government. She left. She came back and is the minister of the environment. And her real concern is to hold back on oil extraction, not here where the BP discovered oil, but also in the mouth of the Amazon River. And that is the tension between those forces that want to really stop the extraction of fossil fuel and those interests in Brazil who believe that it's essential to maintain the economy going, to ensure that there's electric power, although most electric power is fueled by water. But many parts of the economy depend on oil. And so on one hand, sectors of the government are very much freezing the extraction of oil. On the other hand, others argue that the economy requires this. And they also say these are resources that, with taxes on them, can provide serious expansion of social services, the kind of programs that made the Lula government famous. And so there's a real tension between these two wings within the broad coalition government that Lula had put together in order to defeat Bolsonaro in the 2022 elections. It's an open-ended battle that's going to continue.
Yeah. Well, just yesterday, President Lula entered into several agreements with Nigeria's president, including on trade, aviation, technology, potentially even oil. And of course, about 15 years ago, Brazil, along with Russia, India, China, and others, formed BRICS, B-R-I-C-S, as a counterbalance to Western influence. As an expert on Brazilian's history, though, and culture, just how dependent are Brazil and the United States upon one another?
So it's funny because BRICS actually was an invention of an economist in the United States describing good investment possibilities for emerging economies. And so Brazil, Russia, India, and China at the time were seen as good markets because they were expanding, and then South Africa was added. The groups started meeting and realizing that there was a possibility of offering a counterblock to both U.S. influence in the world and also European influence. And have started building this block. It's now extended to 11 other countries. There are 20 people in the BRICS and other associate countries. This is extremely threatening to the Trump administration and is very hostile towards BRICS. They've talked about trying to come up with an alternative currency that would replace the dollar, which Trump has threatened to impose 100 or 200% tariffs on any country that does that. The irony of BRICS is that it has all kinds of different ideologies composed of this group of nations, including democracies or semi-democracies such as India, Brazil, South Africa, but authoritarian states like Russia, China, and some of the Saudi Arabia and some of the oil emirate countries that are applying to be a part of BRICS or going to be in BRICS. So, however, Trump, in his foolishness, and I think not having very good advisors giving him advice, I think he doesn't listen to anyone, has actually pushed Brazil into the arms of China, as other countries. Historically, the United States was the largest trading partner with Brazil. And in the last 20 years, China has become significantly more important because it needs a lot of raw goods and export of agricultural products. And Brazil is providing them. So now Brazil is China is Brazil's largest trading partner. And in fact, with the Trump tariffs, Brazil is looking for more trade with China, which is causing panic among U.S. soybean producers because they think that Brazil has an unfair advantage. And therefore, they're complaining about what Brazil is doing as it's been pushed to seek other markets. Nigeria is the latest example. They're really expanding their look towards other parts of Latin America, to Mexico and other to Canada, to see where they can trade to avoid these ridiculous imposition of tariffs by Trump. And so ironically, in this neo-Cold War battle between the United States and China, Trump is pushing many countries into the arms of what he would perceive as the enemy.
Well, Professor Green, I wanted to ask about minerals, because for years the U.S. has been trying to get unrestricted access to minerals from Brazil that are really crucial for our technology and national security. On August 6th, Lula told Reuters about a new national sovereignty policy that would prevent Brazil's raw minerals from being exported unless Brazil actually received a significant benefit. How might such a policy impact the U.S.?
So this, again, is something of a long tradition. Brazil, in the colonial period in 1695, discovered huge amounts of gold, which fueled the Portuguese Empire and provided the gold in the 17th, 18th century of Europe. And basically, Brazil benefited very little. The poor people benefited very, very little from that, as most of the gold went to the crown, who got a large tax on that. And so there's a strong sentiment about natural resources. This is an idea that also exists in Iberia, where traditionally, historically, from the Middle Ages, the king owned all mineral rights under the land. People could own land, but under the land, the king offered it. Now, the king was not going to go out and mine it, so he would extract a tax of 20% on that land. So in Brazil, in the 40s and 50s, there was a strong movement to nationalize oil, and they did so and set up a national oil company. And now there's a strong sentiment about protecting other rare minerals against foreigners coming in and just scooping up and taking all the benefits. And so Lula's attempting to do that. It's going to be interesting to see what Trump will do. If we recall, Trump recently negotiated the rare minerals from Ukraine, but actually those were detected and studied, the transition from a socialist regime to a capitalist regime, and it's not at all clear in Ukraine how much of these materials can actually be mined and to how valuable they are and how much of them go to the United States. But Trump claimed this was a wonderful victory of his. So I think Brazil is in a very shaky moment with the United States. And so I think they're going to be very careful to not having imposed on them the demand that all their rare minerals go to the United States. And again, as they're trading more with China and China also wants them, they're going to also see the possibility of trading these minerals with China.
Well, also, Professor Green, you're co-founder and president of the board of the Washington Brazil office. And in March, that office published a report on U.S.-Brazil relations, including the subject of immigration. So how has the current U.S. immigration policy impacted Brazilian nationals?
So there are about 1,800,000 Brazilians in the United States. We don't have exact statistics, but that's a reasonable estimate. And among maybe 300,000 to 400,000 are undocumented. The largest communities are in the Boston area, and then it's followed by New Jersey, New York, Miami, Florida, Houston, Texas, and then scattered in other places. But they're all over Brazilians are all over the country. And like all other immigrants, there's really a campaign of terror against them, people being arrested, masked people, picking up people on the streets, arresting them, deporting them. And one of the challenges that the Brazilian immigrants have is that they have historically, because they speak Portuguese and not Spanish, and because they've always seen themselves as not a part of, culturally, historically, a part of South America or Latin America, they haven't been as integrated into the organizations that are defending immigrant rights. So they're kind of standing alone, and it's very hard for them right now. There have been massive deportations, daily flights going to Brazil of undocumented workers. And, you know, I have worked with Brazilian immigrants in this country for many, many years. They're the hardest working, like all Central American and Latin American immigrants who come, 90% of them are incredibly, or 95% are incredibly hardworking, sending money to their families in their home countries, working two or three jobs, doing all the work that no U.S. citizen is interested in doing, and now they're suffering from the consequences. And, of course, like Trump's policy overall, this is going to have a big blowback on the U.S. economy, because they're not going to find people to do the work of the undocumented workers who receive minimum wage or less than minimum wage, are very vulnerable in their workplaces. And this is going to fuel inflation in this country, which I think is Trump's biggest vulnerability, which is why he does everything possible to distract us from issues connected to the economy by throwing in our face all these other ideas and crazy things he is pushing on the American people daily.
Professor Green, we are running out of time, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about the elections that are coming up in Brazil, presidential elections in October 2026. What are your thoughts about that?
So in 2020, when the far right tried to challenge the election results, fortunately, Biden was the president, and he was extremely good about defending democracy, recognizing Lula's election victory immediately, and sending a real clear signal to the armed forces not to carry out a coup. And one of the reasons why the coup was unsuccessful was because the armed forces was split. However, now we have Trump in power. Trump will clearly be weighing in on the far right and supporting the far right candidate, whoever it is. And I'm very, very concerned about the possibility of, once again, the United States trying to pull off some kind of coup or some kind of military intervention or certain covert, if not overt, interventions in the election. So we must be very vigilant. It's very important. Brazil is the largest democracy in Latin America, and at this point, one of the largest progressive democracies, as many of the countries of South America and Central America are turning to the right in recent elections. So it's going to be very important for us to follow the elections in Brazil in 2026 in October, and then we'll see what happens in the congressional elections in November of 26.
Well, on that last note then, but where can listeners learn more about what's going on in Brazil and more about your own work?
Well, I am a retired professor at Brown University, but you can go to my website, which is on the website of the History Department at Brown University. But for the Washington Brazil office, you can go to braziloffice.org and subscribe to our weekly newsletter and read and find out all about what we're doing and learn more about Brazil. We'd love to have you join us in this adventure of understanding a beautiful and complex country.
Wonderful.
Well, Professor James Green, thank you so much for joining us today on the Lawyers Guild Show.
Call me back anytime. Brazil is really important. I want to do anything I can to inform our listeners about the situation in that country.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's the Lawyers Guild Show for today. Thanks so much to our guest, Alvaro Huerta from Immigrant Defenders Law Center and Brazil expert, Professor James N. Green. Thanks also to my co-host, Jim Lafferty, and our wonderful board op, D'Angelo Jones. We will be back next week. And until then, stand up for your rights.
Stand up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. Is that all that Peter is going?
Can you really place a monetary value on a musical experience like listening to John Lee Hooker play the blues? It might be difficult, but I want you to give it a try. You know what your television experience is worth, though sometimes you might not agree when the cable bill comes every month. And if paying anywhere from $5 to $15 a month for your TV streaming experience is indispensable, how about donating a few dollars a month to the station that brings you some of the finest blues, jazz, reggae, world dance, and Latinx music? Not to mention the coverage we bring you on arts and culture. Yes, even our unique music and arts shows need your support to keep us on the air. And when you give, you too keep our fearless journalism going as well. Support independent, fearless radio. Give now at kpfk.org or call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. Because KPFK is priceless.
Can't you see hard times are here to stay?
Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Joy Guidry on October 4th at the Nimoy. Guidry performs excerpts from her new album, Five Prayers. A celebrated voice in experimental and avant-garde music spaces, Guidry pairs the bassoon with low rumbling synths, warm electronic sounds, and poetry that reflects the artist's lived experience as a Black trans woman from the South. Further information and tickets available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Kurt Elling.